Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we meet some of our most influential musicians and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is the frontman with one of the UK's best loved bands. Since they formed, they've weathered 20 years of changing trends and fashions, they've survived the storms of fortune and tragedy, and emerged some 11 albums later as devoted and dedicated to their music as they were when they first got together. I am delighted to introduce, from The Charlatans, Mr. Tim Burgess. And I started by asking Tim when he was first aware of music.
I was in my mum and dad's first house, a place called Linkfield Drive, which was in Salford. And I must have been about 6 years old, and my grandparents were there. And I think she bought me a jacket for my birthday or something like that. I think it was, must have been, maybe it wasn't actually a birthday. I think it was probably just a gift. And on the TV, Thin Lizzy was on Top of Pops. And I just remember thinking, these people look amazing.
just swore that you loved me. Never would you leave me. But the devil take that woman, for you know she treat me easy. But your ring, dumb a do dumb a da. Wake for my daddy, oh. Wake for my daddy, oh. There's whiskey in the jar, oh.
What about the first single that you owned? Do you remember that?
Yeah, the first single that I owned was Long Haired Lover from Liverpool by Lord Jimmy Osmond, and Snow White and the Seven Dwarves on album.
To enjoy the whole kind of having the record and putting it on, even at that young age, were you quite excited by?
I mean, this is like when I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. Yes, I mean the first proper record that I bought was Like Clockwork by Bhutan Rats, which is quite a cool record, I suppose. That's a great record. What we're talking about?
What did you like about it?
TikTok bit. And again, well, see, the thing is, I mean, I think what I'm trying to say throughout this whole confusing conversation is that Top of the Pops was really pivotal for me when I was growing up, because it was that on the Thursday, the TV show, but also the Sunday as well, as a kind of like countdown thing, was just like really important to me, because, well, the whole family used to listen, you know. And everyone would have their favourite song that was in the charts. And I guess mine jumped pretty rapidly from, well, what seems quite rapidly from, like, Little Jimmy Osmond through to Slade, the Bay City Rollers, Thin Lizzy. And then my moment, huge awakening, came when I saw the Vibrators do Automatic Lover. Would have been probably 78, I think, if my memory serves me rightly.
Did that just totally captivate you?
Yeah, I became a punk overnight, yeah.
I was warned up by my mother. the first gig you went to, a punk gig?
Yeah, it's Crass in Winsford. My folks moved from Salford to a place called Northwich when I was maybe seven or eight years old. Northwich is kind of like a satellite town or a new town, a kind of thing. It's kind of Northwich was associated with Manchester, and Winsford, which is only like 4 or 5 miles away, was associated with Liverpool. So it's kind of somewhere right in the middle. So for me, it was a close gig to go to, only maybe 4 miles, you know, but to another new town that was around.
What do you remember about the gig itself? Because first gigs are always, it's you never forget the first gig you went to, no matter what it is.
It didn't really feel like a first gig because it was in a scout hall.
That's not really punk rock.
But that's kind of what I later learned later, about Crass, that they always wanted to do stuff that was off the beaten track kind of thing, you know, to actually not always play the big cities. What I do remember about it is that obviously it was pretty small. There's like lots of people handing out leaflets and there's like banners and you know on the back, like I think it said fight war, not wars, and there's like you know, big sort of, well, I guess they were political statements, but I didn't really kind of like understand it, to be honest with you. I was just really, my friends had got Stations of the Crass and Reality Asylum, the single, and I just bought an album. It was called Penis Envy, and for me it was amazing because the band were made up of men and women. But this album was entirely sung by the women in the band. And it kind of made me think about, as a 13-year-old, as kind of, obviously, I had a crush on all the women in the band. But also, the message was, you know, women's lib and feminism and, you know, kind of like, I don't know, kind of just...
Very powerful.
Very powerful. Yeah. And kind of, so I kind of became a feminist overnight.
You have a punk and a feminist in this space.
And a vegetarian. So it was kind of like really, you know, it's kind of quite weird for a 13-year-old in a village just outside a small town.
Totally changed your life.
Yeah.
Talk about revolution. Oh, that's fine. But what are you going to be doing come the time? Are you gonna be the big man, the Tommy gun? We talk of freedom when the blood begins to run. Freedom has no value if violence is the price. So I want your revolution. I want anarchy and peace. You talk about violence. You speak of liberation, and when the people roll, well, and these people roll right now with bullets for their feet. Just another set of bullets, their rifles are to me. But what about those people who don't want your new restrictions? Those who disagree with you and have their own convictions. You say they've got it wrong because they don't agree with you. So when the revolution comes, you have to run through. You say that revolution bring freedom for us all. Well, freedom just like freedom when your back's against the wall. You talk about fame, power, with violence, that's your tool. You speak of liberation, and when the people rule, well, only people rule right now with turn for their fate. Just another set of prayers, they're up for sons of me. Will you indoctrinate the masses to serve your new regime? And simply do away with those whose views are too extreme. Transportation details be left to British Rail. Where Zyklon B succeeded, North Sea gas will fail. It's just the same old story of man destroying man. You've got to look for other answers to the problems of this land. You talk about crime, power, refinance and your soul.
What about the first band you're in? What were they like? What were they called as well? Because come on, young bands always have...
The first band that I was ever in was a band called The Gin Goblins.
It's Pretty bad name.
It's a terrible name.
What were they like?
Well, you know, quite confused, really, because we just... Everybody played what they had. There was a bass, there was a drums, there was a keyboard, there was a synth. SH-101 synth. Really great synth, but, you know, we didn't really know how to use it or anything like that. And there was a girl in the band as well. So it's kind of quite a good four-piece.
What kind of covers did you do, or was it original stuff?
Yeah, no, we did Joy Division covers.
Which ones?
Into Zone, Transmission. Yeah, the good ones. You know, we did a cult song, Spirit Walker, as well.
Tune.
Yeah,
that's a good tune.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, so moving forward, when you first joined the Charlatans, you weren't the first Charlatan singer, were you? There was another dude before you.
Yeah.
What was it first like when you first kind of stepped into the rehearsal studio with them? Can you remember that, the first time you played together?
I'd seen them a few times. I'd seen them actually play in Northwich. I'd seen them in Manchester a couple of times too. And I liked some of their songs that they had with the original guy who was singing. But when I got to... After, you know, he'd left, I showed up and went through a couple of the songs that he'd sang, and it was working okay. It was fine, you know. It wasn't amazing, but it was good.
It was good enough to think, yes, this is worth
it. Yeah, this is pretty good. But on this, and then still on the same day, they had a couple of instrumentals that they'd been working on since he'd left. And one of them became Flower, and one of them became a song called Always In Mind. But just on working on those two songs in that rehearsal room, the very first time I went down, we all kind of knew that it was something really special.
And the first gig was really good, or was it...
The first gig was...
Stressful?
No, because, I mean, you know, we all knew that we wanted to use oil lamps, and we got oil lamps, kind of a very kind of early Pink Floyd... I don't know where we got hold of them from, but I think Rob had them. And we walked on stage to Age of Aquarius by Fifth Dimension, followed by Across the Universe. So it kind of like we mixed this tape to go into each other, and we kind of walked on. We played seven songs with all these oil lamps and kind of lots of hair, you know, bowl haircuts, and it was a statement of intent, you know.
Change my world. Nothing's gonna change. across the universe. Thoughts meander like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. Exciting and inviting me. Limitless undying love which shines around me like a million suns. It calls me on and on across the universe.
About recording the very first single.
It was very exciting because Chris Nagel agreed to do it, and Chris was Martin Hannett's engineer for all the early Factory stuff, both Joy Division records, First New Order record, and Chris had also produced stuff that I really loved, like the Mini Pops and the Stockholm Monsters and bands on Factory, and GBH, actually, sort of punk bands that I was really into in the past. So I kind of like, I was really excited that we got him to do it. So we went into Strawberry Studios again, steeped in history, you know, Manchester history, Unknown Pleasures being recorded there.
Must have been quite intimidating.
It was just, it was amazing because I'd only ever seen photographs of Martin Hannett and you know, and Ian Curtis in there, and but I just felt that it was, that was the path that I wanted to follow, and you know, I was 21 and kind of like, you know, looking for a bit of guidance, and you know, I knew that having Chris there was amazing. But we had this song called Indian Rope, and basically what it was, I don't know, a 6 minute long organ solo, really.
And nothing wrong with that.
It was kind of like, it was like we thought this is the fresh new sound, cosmic psych pop.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with it, with, you know, massive Hammond organ solo.
Yeah, with a massive, it's just a massive Hammond organ solo, really.
What's not to like? You're listening to The First Time on Six Music with me, Matt Everett.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
First record, Sun Friendly, you know, it made a really big impact straight away.
Yeah.
It went to number one.
Yeah.
For a first album, right out the traps like that, that's pretty impressive. Did you enjoy all the attention that kind of surrounded that, or did it kind of freak you out a little bit?
I think a little bit of both. It was kind of weird because, I mean, it made everything seem possible for real people who wanted to make great music. I remember the Daily Mirror saying that we were the first band to debut at number one since Johnny Hates Jazz, which was like 4 years before that. And I was thinking, that's daunting. But at the same time, Johnny Hates Jazz was kind of a fabricated band.
Second album, Rob Collins, your hammer organ player, did 4 months in prison. This is after put in prison for armed robbery. He was waiting in his mate's car while his mate robbed the post office.
Yeah,
he said he didn't know anything about it. What was your first reaction when you found out what had happened? Because everything had been going pretty well up to that point.
We just got back from Japan, and we were about to start our third album. We were all really going through. Our second album basically was quite experimental and quite electronic. And while we were on this tour, we really enjoyed playing the songs, but we thought, we're going to come back and we're going to strip it back down again. We're going to go back to our roots. And, you know, we were already thinking about the sound, kind of like Small Faces influence, and maybe, you know, Brian Ogre and the Trinity kind of influence again, kind of get something. I suppose it's kind of what I think it was just the whole thing about coming home, you know, that kind of like, you know, wanted to get back to the roots kind of vibe again. And then the next morning Martin was going to pick me up to take me to Stockport. We were rehearsing in Stockport, and I got a phone call from our manager saying, don't go see your rehearsal because Rob's in jail. And I was like, oh. What for? He said, armed robbery. And yeah, it's pretty serious, and I don't think he'd be going in for the rest of the week. I was like, okay. So slowly, as with everything that seems to happen with the channel, and slowly more bits of information sort of like seems to come through, and I'll learn more and more as time goes on. But he was, you know, he's involved in an armed robbery. What can you say to that, really? Yeah.
You mentioned there that the kind of like there was a kind of different direction, sort of different directions creeping in for that record, definitely the record after The Charlatans.
Yeah,
more kind of classic sounds. What were the big records you were listening to?
Well,
this evolution in the sound.
Myself and Martin first kind of got talking. It was before I started singing with the band. We were just completely talking about a band called The Prisoners, and they're a band from mid-80s on Big Beat Records, and they were from Chatham, but they kind of did a really good updated sound of the Small Faces. So we were kind of like somewhere we wanted, like the kind of like Small Faces classic kind of Ogden's Not Gone Flake era organ, sort of like wild drums, Kenny Jones style drums, and meets kind of like the Prisoners updated version, which was kind of like a little dirtier and a little more garagey. So it was a retro sound we were looking for, really.
Charlatans, it seemed to come together so well. It did incredibly well again.
Yeah,
a rebirth, a bit of an artistic
rebirth.
You really sort of connected with sort of people again.
Yeah,
that must have felt really good as well.
I never really know why that happens, really, but I mean, it feels good when it does. Yeah,
in the middle of all this positivity, you're recording the next album, Telling Stories.
Yeah,
96. Rob passes away. Rob dies in a car crash. During the recording, what were you doing when you first found out?
Well, we were in the car before him. He was following us, and speeding up quite fast behind us. But then we turned off into Mono Valley Studios, and you know, and he didn't show up. So we just thought that he'd gone to get some cigarettes, or you know, gone joyriding or something. And the next thing we know, the police arrived at the studio and they were just asking, about Rob Collins and what did he play in the band. And it was kind of like very weird, but still, again, quite clueless as what had happened. He did say there was an accident and that he was in hospital and we should go and see him. And that's kind of what we did, me and Mark. And when we got there, I parked up with a friend of ours. A friend of ours was driving. We parked up, Mark ran into the hospital, and when I got in there, Mark came up to me and said he's dead.
He was a very unique character, wasn't he?
He was incredible, yeah. Really cool guy, actually.
He was.
I mean, it's kind of amazing when you look back at his playing. It's a really good... some really good footage from an Astoria gig that we did in around about 95, and his playing and singing was just so cool. It's like really effortless, you know.
Go together before the last.
When did you first decide you were going to carry on without him?
Quite quickly after, really. We felt that it was, that people would think that we could quite easily stop. This was all in the night that he was dying, the night that he died. We were thinking, well, we'll never know if we stop now. We'll never know what could happen. I mean, it could all fail terribly, or it could, we could write some really great songs in Los Angeles or something like that, you just never know what's going to happen. So we have to carry on. But then there was always doubt as well. Now, the thing is that what happened is that we were scheduled to play Loch Lomond and Nebworth with Oasis. Everyone in 96 was opening for Oasis at Nebworth. Prodigy, Chemical Brothers, Manic Street Preachers, Ocean Colosseum, Charlatans. Everyone who was of any kind of importance at that time or was kind of opening for them on these big shows. And we obviously thought we couldn't do it. So I rang up our press guy at the time, a guy called Jeff Barrett from Heavenly. And I said, we can't do it, obviously. And he's like, hold on a minute, you've got to do it. And I was like, we can't. And he's like, no, you've got to do it. Just give me 10 minutes. And in the next 10 minutes, Bobby Gillespie called and said, Duffy doesn't know yet, but I'm going to put it forward. He's going to do it. I was like, all right. Oh, well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for even thinking about us, And he's like, no problem. I'll get Barrett onto it. So, and then the next, 2 days later, we were rehearsing in the Midlands, actually, with Martin Duffy, who had only ever met before underneath a table in backstage in Amsterdam. We were having about a 4-hour conversation under a table. About not a lot in particular, but that was Primal Scream, Charlatans and Cypress Hill all in one room. It's pretty heavy.
And, And Telling Stories is a great record. Really good records. It's one of the best.
Yeah, it is. I think it is one of the best. I mean, Rob left us a lot of stuff. He left us lots of ideas, and he'd played parts on the songs, but not fully on anything, I don't think, apart from One to Another, which had been completed and released. So the first thing Martin Duffy, the next thing coming up was North Country Boy, and Martin came in firstly he did the gigs. We didn't manage to do the Loch Lomond one, it was too early, but we did do the Nebworth one, and we did Chelmsford V as well. So it's kind of good to get back on a feet. Jeff Barrett said it's like riding a bike, you got to get back on it once you fall off it. Like, all right, cool. So after we did the gigs, Martin agreed to come and help us finish the album as well, which was amazing. And we just took it like step by step.
When did you decide to move to LA? When was the first time you thought, I'm going to move to Los Angeles? And the question I want to ask was, what's, when you first moved there and you were driving your car around with the windows down, yeah, when you first moved, what were you playing? What was the music you listened to going, yeah?
That's really easy. It was Curtis Mayfield, Back to the World. That was the record that I was playing.
That kind of summed up this new world you were about to embark.
Yeah, it really was, because it was like, I guess that record is like 1974 or something like that, that record, but it's kind of really, it's kind of, you know, the 70s soul when it got kind of really colourful, you know, like I guess Funkadelic had a sort of like really colourful soul thing going on as well in the 70s. But that was the record that driving down the freeway kind of like made a lot of sense to me. When did I move to Los Angeles? When did I decide to? We had one gig planned in LA, and we spent a whole week at a place called Le Parc Suites. It's in West Hollywood. And I met this girl called Michelle, and kind of just became really good friends with her, really. Similar music taste, really. I mean, that's kind of what started it all. And, you know, we all went on a merry way, and then I just decided that I would come back and visit her again after the band went to Japan. We went from LA to Japan, and I came back to LA to hang out with Michelle, really. And then we fell in love, and I decided that I wanted to live in LA.
Final question, the final question we ask everybody who does this show. What's the last record that we'll play? We'll play out on a record of your choice. It can be one of yours, it can be a record you've always loved, it can be anything you want.
Oh, wow.
Your choice.
If you have it as well, Right On Through the Darkness is quite good by Curtis Mayfield.
Why that one?
Well, I feel it's kind of like quite, you know, the whole thing that's happened with John lately from the band. You know, I just think that this is kind of quite a motivational one.
How is he doing at the moment?
I don't think he's doing very well, really. I mean, his spirits are really up, but I think he's, you know, he has to have 6 weeks of chemo and radiation. So, I guess this one's for him.
It's really good to speak to you, Tim. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, yeah.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Victims of fun, come on, come on. The fun has just begun, come on, the fun has just begun.